Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
Today's program has been brought to you by Wines of Bordeaux. Visit their website at Bordeaux.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey folks, Michael Michael here. Welcome to Food Talk on this crazy week here in the United States of America. Wow. Holy shit. Who saw that coming? Apparently nobody. Yikes. 4 years of President Trump. I can barely utter those words. I don't know if we can watch the news for a while. But anyway, on to more pleasant subjects. New York was home to the first yet in America, Raw Wine Festival, which is the brainchild of Isabelle Legrand, a French expat living in London now, a master of wine, which is quite a distinction in and of itself. And she's a huge proponent of natural wines, which is a term that's kind of being bantered about these days to encompass organic and biodynamic, at low SO2, if not no SO2 wines, non-interventionist wines. There's a whole bunch of different descriptors for these. And it was a great success. It was held just one subway stop from where I'm sitting here at Roberta's, which is the Morgan stop. It was one stop further out on the L train, the Jefferson stop, in a space I'd never been to before, but sort of emblematic of the whole scene here. It was, you know, you're sitting next to construction cranes and auto body shops and razor wire. Then you enter off the street to this great little wine bar and a huge event space. It was sold out Sunday. There were 1,000 people that paid the tickets to come in and taste wines from winemakers that really had come from all over the planet. The list was curated by Fuchsia. And Fuchsia, excuse me, is my next guest, Isabella. And Monday was amazing, too. I think they sold out Monday as well. I had a panel day with Tony Couturi, who's one of the OG bio-organic guys out of California, who's amazing, his story. He's been making natural wines in Sonoma County since, like, the late 70s, which is crazy because nobody was doing it then. Nobody was doing it 10 years later or 10 years after that. And fast forward to today, and he's still a real oddity out there. There's a few producers in Northern California, Sonoma, Napa. Very, very few, to be honest with you. So he's just one of those guys who's been doing it. His family's been doing this forever. So it's nice to meet him in person. He's kind of a legend. But here's today's show in a nutshell. I'm happy to have back, I believe, and I can, Fuchsia can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think when I was at WOR back in the days when I was doing that show 6 days a week, out of 111 Broadway downtown, we had a phone interview with Fuchsia for one of her books. She's great. She's a British-based food writer. I'm guessing she fell in love with Chinese food when she was the BBC news correspondent, and I'm assuming, based there. She'll tell me that. She has, at the moment, I have 5 books, maybe 6, that have all been boring down on various aspects of Chinese cooking, and her most recent one is Land of Fish and Rice, Recipes from the Culinary Heart of China. After Fuchsia, we're going to run this for about 20 minutes, take a quick break, and then I've got Alice Firing coming in. Alice and I are old buddies, and we're going to switch gears and talk wine for the last half of the show. Alice has been one of the long proponents of the natural wine movement here stateside, back really when nobody was talking about it, when she was really considered kind of a crazy outlier. But that's been what she's been doing. That's her bailiwick since as long as I've known her. So we're going to talk about the Raw Wine event, what she does, Wines of Georgia, which is something that she specializes in. But first, let me welcome for the first time here for Food Talk at Heritage, Fuchsia Dunlop. Fuchsia, thanks for coming on.
Hello.
Nice to meet. Am I wrong? Did we do an interview years ago, or do you not remember?
No, we did, but I can't remember the name of the show, but we did definitely talk a few years ago.
Yeah, it was a while back. So anyway, pleasure. So just by way of backstory, because I'm famous for like mangling stuff like this, to tell me when, I mean, your every one of your books, is this the sixth or the fifth? Did I get that part
this
right?
This is the fifth, but one of them has different titles in the United States and Britain, which is why you might think there are six.
Okay, all right. So whatever. I'll give myself a B on that one. But what was it the time you did as a East Asian analyst for BBC News? Is that kind of what put you in head first into the whole world of Chinese cuisine?
Well, I first got interested in China when I had a sub-editing job for part of the BBC, and I was reading all this stuff about the Asia-Pacific region. But the China thing really started when I went, as a result of this job, I just went on holiday to China and fell in love with it and started learning Mandarin in evening classes and then got a scholarship to study in China full-time for a year. And that's when, you know, I very quickly got distracted from my academic studies and ended up spending all my time in kitchens. And then from there I ended up being the first Westerner to study at this famous Sichuanese cooking school in Chengdu. And that really changed the course of my life.
It's crazy, right? Plan as we will, when destiny taps you on the shoulder.
Yeah, or when really good food sort of tempts your appetite and you just can't resist.
So the latest book, is you've been putting these out, I guess, once every couple of years, you seem to have a new one out. And they're great. They're always Norton as the publisher?
Yeah, in the United States, Norton all the way through.
Okay, because they're beautiful. I mean, they're beautifully put together. The covers are gorgeous. The photos are great. Who was the photographer for this one?
The photographer of this is this wonderful Japanese woman in London called Yuki Sugiura, who, yeah, I mean, I love the photo. She was a joy to work with.
Yeah, it's not, it's funny because, you know, sometimes you see like overly produced and that's just every one of these shots from, you know, the pot sticker dumplings to the steam fish, like every one of them, I'm like, I want that. This is so beautiful. It's just so nicely done. Looks like if she didn't use natural light, she fooled me, but they're just beautifully, beautifully shot. It's a great book. Again, the name of the book is Land of Fish and Rice, Recipes from the Culinary Heart of China. Fuchsia Dunlop is my guest. So kind of in America, like in a nutshell, you're here all the time. I know you were here. I missed you on the tour. We just couldn't coordinate the days you were available and the days I was available doing the show. And I think I was out one of those weeks. But, you know, we kind of know Cantonese food here. That was one of the, you know, early styles in Sichuan and in New York City. There's a couple of Yunnan restaurants around and kind of mishmashes of this and that. But Jiangnan, talk about this place in China, because it took you a while to write about this, but it seems like the history is remarkable.
Yeah, well, the Jiangnan region in Chinese means south of the river, south of the Yangtze
right.
River, and that's the region including Shanghai, but the Shanghai and the two inland provinces, Zhejiang and Jiangsu, and it's really one of the ancient centers of Chinese gastronomy and has a tradition going back hundreds of years of fine food, of cookery books, of people, poets rhapsodizing about the food and sort of highly technical and accomplished cooking. But it's not very well known in the West at all. You know, everyone's heard of Shanghai.
Right.
And in New York, actually, you do have a few Shanghainese restaurants.
Yeah, Joe's Shanghai is one right on Byard Street downtown.
Exactly. But and China Blue I went to the other day, which is wonderful, sort of modern Shanghainese. But you know, this is a great region. It's not just about Shanghai. There's Shaoxing, where the famous rice wine comes from, Hangzhou with its beautiful West Lake, Yangzhou. All these places have really fantastic dishes and, you know, fascinating food cultures.
Who is this early on? You've got this. So the book is laid out with this kind of, is it called an introduction, or what do you call that sort of long part in the beginning that tells the story of the region and the history of the region?
Yeah, the introduction.
But it's great. It's longer than usual, and it's a completely riveting read because it kind of talks about the region, the history of the region, the ingredients that it's rich with. And then suddenly this character appears whose nickname is Odd Dai. Talk to me about this. the chef.
Oh, Adai. His proper name is Dai Jianjun.
Right.
And he's a remarkable man who owns an extraordinary restaurant in Hangzhou. And it's sort of like, you know, if you think of Chez Panisse and their, you know, concern with ingredients, with provenance, with the seasons, this is like the Chinese equivalent. And what Adai has done is sort of revive and preserve the local cooking tradition by recruiting retired chefs from the classic restaurants in Hangzhou. But not only that, he sources all the ingredients from what we would call organic farms and traditional producers. And it's the most exquisite Chinese cooking that I've had in this region. And it's one of the best restaurants in the whole of China. But I met him, in fact, meeting him was a kind of catalyst for the book. I was already a bit interested in the Jiangnan region, but this restaurant just showed me how good the food would be. And I spent a lot of time in the kitchens there and with him and his staff going around to the farms and the fishermen and the producers and learning about where the food comes from as well as how it's actually cooked.
So you mentioned Atlas Waters and Chez Panisse, and that was kind of like the early days of the San Francisco scene, circa mid-70s. She was kind of a pioneer in this for various reasons. Some of it was just coincidental. Her dad was encouraging her to keep food costs down by buying from farmers, which turned out to be a good idea on a whole lot of levels. But fast forward now to today, and of course, you know, you travel back and forth, and I'm sure it's the same with the London food scene, which is on fire. But, you know, down here in the States, like, everything's farm to table, everything's local. We've got farmers markets all the time. In China, for whether it's fine dining or regular dining, is that still kind of an outlier, what Adai's doing?
Is
that still an outlier? This idea of being so specific in sourcing great ingredients. I mean,
well,
I read that section on him.
Modern
and
China is quite radical, but China actually has a tradition going back hundreds, if not thousands of years, long before California and the Nordic countries discovered this kind of concern. Chinese gourmets have sought out the finest produce from the right place in the right season and have been extraordinarily concerned with the ingredients and how they're used. And so, in a way, what Adai is doing is resurrecting a tradition that's got slightly lost with China's sort of cultural revolution and rapid industrialization and sort of bringing it up to date. But actually, it has really ancient roots in China, much longer, actually, than in the West.
Yeah, you talk about that, the sort of rhapsodizing. I mean, going back literally thousands, many hundreds of years, quoting philosophers and poets and chefs. I love that line of thinking of peach and water shield. Is that it? Perch and water shield. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's there's this legend that in the 4th century, an official of the Jin dynasty, Jiang Han, who was posted to a job in the north of China, he missed the sliced perch and water shield soup of his hometown in the Jiangnan region so much that he abandoned his post and went home. That's how much people love the food of this region.
I was about to say, a committed foodie from a long, long time ago. So talk about the lay of the land, because we have, before we go into the recipes, which are great, I want people to get a sense of the geography. So we have Shanghai, and we have Jiangsu to the north. It goes inland, so there's some ginormous lakes in there, right? Didn't you write about some huge lake in there?
Yeah, well, this whole region, it's a very watery region.
Right, you've got a whole coastline, too, I should say.
Coastline.
Right.
And also many lakes and rivers. And that's one of the things that's really interesting about the food of the region is the water foods. So not only an absolutely fabulous range of seafood from the coast, but also lots of freshwater creatures, not just fish, but also crabs, eels, delicious little slippery freshwater shrimp, and also water vegetables. And again, not just the familiar lotus root and water chestnut, but things like wild rice stem and fox nuts and water shield. So all these extraordinary water plants and creatures, which are one of the most distinctive aspects of the local cuisine.
What is water shield?
Well, water shield is a sort of, it's like a kind of water plant with little grey-green leaves. And each little leaf tip is covered in, it sounds horrible in English, but a layer of transparent slime. But in Chinese, it has a gorgeous, slippery mouthfeel. It's incredibly refreshing and delicious. So it's one of these foods that's prized as much for its texture as for its taste.
Right. I'm guessing that for Westerners that are squeamish about, like, consistency of food, it may be a kind of off-putting.
Well, just I think just a little surprising. But I think if you have someone to explain it to you, and it looks so beautiful, so you have this clear broth with these grey-green leaves, usually garnished with little wisps of chicken breast and pink ham. So it does look beautiful and appetizing. And if you're prepared to just give it a go, you'll probably love it.
So you've got this big coastline that's saltwater. You've got rivers going in, and then you've got these lakes. And also, rice is front and center here.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the main rice-growing regions of China, and in fact, some of the earliest people to domesticate rice were in this region. And so rice is the staple food, so you get not only steamed rice, but soupy rice, congee, fried rice, and also sort of lots of rice dumplings and things. So rice is definitely the staple food of this region.
Talk to me. There's a picture on page 16 of a gentleman with a hat on, knee-deep in some kind of a bog, and he's gathering underwater fruits, starchy foxnut.
That's the foxnut that I just mentioned.
That's the one you're talking about. Okay.
Extraordinary plants. So you get these big ponds and huge leaves, a bit like waterloo leaves on the surface, and underneath you get these sort of fruits that look a bit like pomegranates. And if you break them open, you get all these round seeds. And if you pull off the outer coating of the seed, you get these little white nuts, like they're about the size of pearls, bright white. And they're a great delicacy. And they're often used in the cooking of Suzhou, which is a canal city you might know for its classical gardens, which are very famous.
All right. Early on in the book, and where do I have a note here? It's funny because it looks like a little bar snack, but the more I looked at it and read the recipe, I'm like, I want this. Of course, you know, I was probably reading the book hungry, but or it made me hungry. Page 36, this crispy seaweed and peanuts. Talk about this crazy dish. What is this?
Well, that's another of the saltwater products, but Ningbo on the coast, which is a city just south of Shanghai, they have this amazing kind of seaweed, which is known sometimes as sea moss or branch string lettuce. So it's long green strands, and when they're dried, you get these kind of skeins of dark green seaweed. Now, if you deep fry it, it has a very crisp texture, and it has this delicious umami flavor. Mm. And one of the ways you can use it in sweet dishes and savory dishes, but one of the ways they eat it is with fried peanuts, like a sort of appetizer with a bit of salt and a bit of sugar, and it's delicious.
The very, very next page, there was a moment in time when, you know, I've got a PBS show in New York for going into my 15th year and was a chef and had on and off have done radio for quite some time. So I eat out a lot and I read a lot, and it seemed like about a year ago, it was popping up on all these menus all over the city, this kind of cucumber dish where the cucumber was sort of not crushed but kind of whacked first.
And smacked cucumber, that's the word.
Smacked cucumber. Right, and then you've got this, it's the very next page after that little seaweed and peanut thing. And it kind of reminds me of what I was working with Dookie Hong this year for the PBS show. He's a Korean chef based in New York. Young kid, great, great guy. And we were talking about, you know, obviously if you're talking Korean food, you're talking kimchi. And he likes to use like kimchi-ing things, like it's an active verb where you can kind of, you don't have to just make traditional kimchi, you can create a kind of the kimchi flavor base and then kimchi almost anything you want. And you've got this great looking quick cucumber salad, which we kind of make this at home in my house once in a while, because not this one, but the idea, because cucumbers are so malleable, and you know, with a little salt and a little vinegar and leave them out, they're quick to ferment, they break down, there's a lot of water. Talk about this, because this just really looks delicious. Again, simple and delicious.
Yeah, really, really simple. So it's just basically cucumber, salted a bit to get out some of the water, and then mix it with a brown rice vinegar, which has a lovely complex taste, and sugar and garlic. And that sweet and sour flavor with a bit of garlic is very Shanghainese. They have a lot of sweet dishes in Shanghai. So it's kind of refreshing, sweet, sour, and garlicky. It's a lovely appetizer.
And it looks relatively simple to make. Again, this is why I love these recipes where it looks like, honestly, with five ingredients and 15 minutes, you can make this thing at home.
Yeah, totally easy.
Totally easy. Not so easy is this book, this great lotus root stuffed with glutinous rice. I love the picture, and I'm thinking, oh, God, this is a ton of work, but that dish sounded so delicious to me. Talk about this, because there's a fair amount of steps involved, but it sounds like It sounds like if I find it on a menu, I'm ordering it if it's done well. But talk about that dish, because it's really kind of interesting on how they're using lotus root in this.
Yeah, well, that's another dish from sort of Hangzhou and Shanghai, water vegetable lotus root. And a lotus root, so you peel it and you cut off one end of the segment, and you've got holes running all the way through the lotus root, and you stuff them with soaked glutinous rice grains. And then you cook it until it's really tender, and the rice swells up and fills up, you know, the channels through the lotus root. And then you serve it with a kind of syrup, flavored, if you can get them, with osmanthus flowers, which are a lovely floral flavoring of this region. And normally then it's sliced and served with this syrup. And it's got this lovely, sticky, glutinous texture, sweet but not too sweet, and the sort of lovely texture of the huggy texture of the glutinous rice running all the way through.
It really, it looks, again, it's a fair amount of steps to make it, but it looks so darn good to eat.
It's not difficult. You just have to cook it for a while.
Yeah. And how do you get the, when it's whole like that, how do you get the glutinous rice that's been rinsed down? Would you use a piping bag, or what are you using? Just trim?
No, you just stuff it in with a chopstick. So you put your chopstick in the holes to make sure they're all clear, and then stuff all the glutinous rice in. And then put the lid on, put the top of the stem back with a couple of cocktail sticks to hold it in place.
Got you. A buddy of mine and his wife had a restaurant that, unfortunately, it was short-lived this summer, the last spring and this summer. But he had this wonderful play on a Caesar salad, but he was using chrysanthemum leaves instead of romaine. And it was so good. And I'm like, that's a great idea. Talk about this. You have a recipe in here with chrysanthemum leaves with pine nuts where they're blanched and then shocked quickly. But talk about that as an ingredient, because that's something that's readily available in New York Chinese markets.
Yeah, well, it's a lovely vegetable with a very unusual, slightly herby flavor. So it's not just any old chrysanthemum. It's the crown daisy or garland chrysanthemum. So you can't use any. You just got to get the one that they sell in Chinese supermarkets. And, you just blanch it and refresh it to keep that lovely vivid green color. And then fine chop it, and you can add some firm tofu, pine nuts, and then just season it with salt and sesame oil. So it's really simple, refreshing, with this really unusual flavor.
Yeah, that's one I've really got to try, because again, you're right, to your point, I know exactly what that leaf looks like, and they do sell it in the Chinese markets. I live downtown, so I live very close to Chinatown, so I it's in the markets almost year round, I think, down here. Another dish that, again, looks like a dish I might eat if I went out, because it's a little complicated, but it looks so good, and again, your photographer is just killed at the plate's gorgeous, is 8 treasure stuffed calabash duck. Talk about this one.
You have picked the most complicated dish.
I did, sorry.
I wanted to have at least one representative of the tradition in Jiangnan of what they call kung fu cooking, gong fu tai. And that's dishes which are, you know, require technical skill and which are a little complicated but very impressive. So with this, you take a duck and you bone it out completely, and then you make an 8 treasure glutinous rice stuffing, and the treasures are things like green soybeans, little bits of ham, dried shrimps. So you make this lovely 8 treasure stuffing and you put it into the duck, and then you cook it several stages to cook it, but you basically end up with this gorgeous bronzed duck in a lovely sauce, decorated on a plate decorated with bright green pak choy, and then at the table you just cut it open and this delicious 8 treasure rice stuffing spills out.
Is this one of those methods where to bone it out you flip it over so it's not the breast side facing you but it's the other side, and you kind of work it open that way so that you can put it back together again, or does it not matter where
you just basically start at the neck and you use kitchen scissors and you snip around.
Okay.
It's all explained in the book. And then you kind of undress the bird from the carcass, take the carcass out, and then turn it inside out so you can blanch it, turn it the right way in, and then stuff it.
And I did.
It takes a little time, but it's...
No, I'm sorry. I picked like the hardest recipe in the book.
Not something you want to rustle up after a hard day's work, but, you know, for a special dinner party or something.
Yeah, you're not going to whip this up like in 20 minutes watching the BBC News. Beggar's chicken. Talk about this one. There's no picture to it, but it just sounded great.
Oh, well, there is a picture. It's a double-page spread.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's the next page. Gotcha. It's over. Yeah.
Of Hangzhou or Changshu in Jiangsu province, depending on who you talk to. And the legend is that a beggar once stole a chicken, didn't have a pot to cook it in, so he wrapped it in mud and then baked it in a fire. So the modern dish, you take a chicken and you marinate it in sort of soy sauce and rice wine and ginger and so on. And then you stuff it with a little leek and pickled mustard and a little pork. And then you wrap it in a soaked lotus leaf, which you can buy dried in Chinese supermarkets, and that will give it a wonderful fragrance. And then traditionally, you then wrap it in mud. But what I've suggested people do, because it's more practical at home, is wrap it in a salt crust pastry.
Right.
So you wrap it, you completely enclose it, and then you bake it in an oven. And then when your guests arrive, you take it out, and you actually use a mallet to smack open the pastry. And then you break it open, unwrap the leaf, and there's this gorgeous, fragrant chicken, beautifully juicy and tender, and with the amazing aroma of the leaf. So that's a kind of spectacular dish. It's not very difficult to do. You just need to get your lotus leaves and, cook it.
And work on salt dust once or twice. The salt dough crust before you try it for the first time with guests. But, yeah, it's great because it kind of steams in there. The beauty of cooking like that is it creates its own, not exactly sous vide, but it's steaming. With all those flavors are interior, and it's when you crack it and open it up, boom, that steam escapes, smells incredible, and usually the results are just beautiful inside.
Yeah, it's a great dish. It's a great centerpiece, and also it has the advantage that it's not, if you do all stir-fried dishes for a Chinese meal, it's very much last-minute work, but that chicken, you can have it cooking in the oven while you prepare the other dishes, so it's very convenient as well.
So when I'm thinking of Chinese cuisine, again, not that I know much, because it's such a big country, it's so varied, but I didn't realize the Chinese had fava beans. So you've got this one, it's another great photograph of hibiscus blossom egg white with fresh fava.
Yeah, well, fava beans are really important in this region. People love eating them in the sort of spring and early summer. And this dish, the hibiscus blossom, is because you've just got egg white, and you cook it very carefully so that you keep its tenderness. So it has this lovely, light, custardy texture. And it's basically stir-fried with the fava beans, which you pod them, and then you shell them. So you just get the tender little hearts. And so it's a really delicate, lovely, savory dish. And also, they usually garnish it with a little bit of chopped cooked ham, so
that's
you get that bright pink color.
Right, that's what's on the top.
White. It's really pretty.
Right, you get a little brunoise of ham, just a little crunch, a little flavor popping. Again, if you tuned in somehow and you missed it, my guest is Fuchsia Dunlop, who has been writing for as long as I can remember these great recipe books that are sort of also travelogues about the various regions of China. We're talking about her latest, which is Land of Fish and Rice Recipes from the Culinary Heart. Let's go to seafood because there's a lot of it in here and there's a lot of it in this region's cuisine. Reeves shad, R-E-E-V-E-S shad. Talk about that fish.
Well, that's one of the great grand dishes of the Yangtze River, although sadly you don't really get them fresh in the Yangtze River anymore. So this is a fish that used to swim up from the oceans every year, and it has a brief season. And the classic way of cooking it is that it's steamed.
That clear steamed sea bass, you're calling it.
The reeve shad is steamed in its scales because they have this lovely oil in them which moistens the flesh. Anyway, it's very difficult to get. You can get frozen reeve shad, but it's difficult to get it fresh even in China. So what I've done is I've told the story of this classic dish and then explained how you can use the same method to steam the more easily available sea bass, because this is a method of steaming that you find across the region. And what you do is you make slits into the fish and you interleave them with slices of ham. And so it just looks beautiful. It's a very delicate, lovely way of steaming fish with a bit of ham and shiitake mushroom just to magnify its savory flavors.
Is the fish, we have a shad here that does the same thing in the spring. It runs up from the Atlantic up the Delaware River. It's a very bony fish. Is this, if you could get that shad or when you could get that shad in China, was it the same way? Was it an oddly bony fish or not so much?
It is a very bony fish, and it's got quite rich flesh, so it's a bit more sort of oily
than
some of the other fish. But
so,
it's fantastically delicious, but yes, it is bony.
So this dish would work, again, if you're living on the East Coast and you're familiar with what I'm talking about. The shad run occurs every spring. We love the shad shad roe. We eat the shad roe. Usually you find the shad. It's pretty hard to find them whole because they're such a pain in the neck to butcher. But you could, if you could, it sounds like an identical, I mean, the Chinese fish that we have that's very similar here. It's a very oily fish. It's a very bony fish, but it's a very, once you get used to it, the flavor is great.
Well, I'd love to try it with an American shad. I haven't done, but I would have to try it because it sounds great.
Yes, but we'll have to get next spring, if you come stateside, we'll give you the name of some fish vendors in New York that could help you. Maybe Lou Razzo can hook you up. You have another dish for red braised fish. Talk about this concept of red braising.
Well, red braising is a concept that you get all over China, but it really is done most masterfully and most often in this region, the Jiangnan region. And red braising is when you use soy sauce and rice wine and sugar to cook ingredients. And they can be fish, can be meat, can be vegetables. And it's from the soy sauce that you get what the Chinese call the red color, that sort of rich, deep, brownish sort of chestnut color. And red braised fish is a sort of typical home-cooked home style, you know, cooking a fish in Shanghai, Hangzhou, all these places. So you normally fry the fish and then you cook it with the soy sauce, rice wine and sugar, and then you let the juices reduce to a wonderful opulent gravy. And this kind of dish is particularly good with plain white rice, which soaks up all those gorgeous juices. And then I would also serve a dish like that with something sort of bright and refreshing like stir-fried pak choi or something to set off the richness of the sauce.
Yeah, you must know Eddie Schoenfeld when he comes to New York. You know Ed?
Yes, we did an event together in New York 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, he's great. He's great. Years back when I wanted to do a sort of tour of Brooklyn, Sunset Park, Chinatown, I used him as my Sherpa back when he was still living in Brooklyn. And then I had him cook some dishes for us. He's great. He's like one of the, knows so much about Chinese food, and he's such a great guy to sort of lead us. He's a, obviously New York born and bred guy, but he's really like my go-to expert around here. All right, we can't talk about this without talking about Chinese steamed soup dumplings. Talk about this, because I think this is one of the most... I remember the first couple times I had them, I was thinking, as a chef, putting on my chef's hat, how the hell did they make that? And then, of course, someone explained it, and I'm like, duh, like, you're a chef. Like, you would know how to do this, dude. Now it makes sense. But talk about them, because we've had these that we have the ones that are mixed pork and crab, but they're just a wonderful thing. But talk about that dish, because that's just a classic.
Yeah, well, the soup dumpling is one of the few dishes or snacks from this region that's achieved international fame, speciality particularly of Shanghai. And what it is, you get these dainty little dumplings with gathered pinched tops, and you pick them up with your chopsticks and you put them in your spoon, and then when you pierce them with a chopstick, all this gorgeous stock flows out. So they're really juicy, and you get a filling which is usually based on pork, though as you say, the luxury ones have crab meat mixed with the pork, and this wonderful stock sauce that comes out. And as you said, the secret to these is that you make a jellied stock, so traditionally with pig's feet or pig's skin, so you get a gelatinous stock, you chill it, and then you can cut it up and you mix it with your meat stuffing, so it's solid when you wrap the dumplings, and then of course as you heat it, all that jellied stock melts out. And there's a sort of trick with them, because obviously the wrappers, the pastry skins of these dumplings, have to be sort of thin enough to be dainty and delicious, but they have to be strong enough to hold in the soup and the stuffing when you pick them up.
It's a genius dish. It's so good. And it's, right, as you said, it's kind of like you make a very nice gelatinous braise with either a great stock that has some gelatin enhanced that could be from, oxtail or pig's feet or whatever, veal feet, anything that adds gelatin. You let that chill, and of course, then it tightens up like a hard as a rock. In that form, you can form it into the dumplings. Then once it's heated, it just like a braise, it just comes apart again. So it's bloody genius. I wonder what the nexus of that dish was. Some chef years ago that came up with that idea. But whoever he or she was, thank you. Stay where you are for 1 second. Fuchsia, is my next guest in? Because we don't have a green room here. Okay, bingo. Fuchsia, we got to run. We could have gone on and on for an hour with this book. There was a bunch of rice dishes that were great, noodle dishes that were great, sweet dishes that were great that we didn't get to. And we didn't talk about pork except for the dumplings, because pork is huge in all over China, but especially in this region. But I kind of wanted to keep it on the... because we think of Chinese, we do think of pork as a protein, but we don't think as much about the fish. We kind of wanted to bore down on the fish dishes in this book.
Yeah, but I do think, this region has some of the best pork dishes in China, in my opinion.
Which is saying a lot, because there's some great pork dishes throughout the land. Thanks so much. I know you're in London, so you're on London time. Hey, how did you feel after the Brexit?
After the Brexit, oh, total shock. I mean, it was a bit like the kind of shock that I think Americans are in right now.
Right. I remember, I will never forget, like, there's now 2 days that I remember. I'll never forget waking up. It was, I think, a Friday in New York. And I woke up in the morning, logged onto my computer, went to the New York Times, saw that it had passed. And I just nearly shat myself because I thought, holy mackerel. Everything I was reading, every friend of mine that lives there, up until the day before, everybody said, no way, no way, no way. It was kind of a joke. And I hate to say it, but I honestly think Donald Trump's presidency was kind of a joke. I honestly don't think he was serious about winning. His polling the day of the election had him losing, as everybody else's polling did, which I think he would have been perfectly happy with, just to get his name in the paper for, you know, a year and be on the news cycle and then go back to being what he is. But this is insanity. So, man, you know.
Yeah, well, we've been through it, you know, and after Brexit, I have to say, I wasn't sort of making any bets on the American election either.
Yeah, me neither. Oh, God, this is whatever. I guess time will heal everything. Thanks so much for coming on. Fuchsia Dunlop's been my guest. The name of the book is The Land of Fish and Rice. Any of her books are great, so if you just Google her name, Fuchsia Dunlop, like the tennis balls or sporting goods stuff, she's great. All her books are great. She her recipe's great. She does the due diligence. She walks the walk and talks the talk. Thanks so much for coming on. Pleasure. Great book.
Thank you so much. It's been fun for me, too.
Thank you. Stay where you are, folks. I've got Alice Firing in the house. We are going to talk about the world of natural wines, her world, and increasingly more and more a world that you're going to find on wine lists and stores growing all the time. So stay tuned for that in a second. Hey folks, Mike Hellemeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Cola Vida family brand for years, and there really is a Cola Vida family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Cola Vida. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Cola Vida family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable source olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Cola Vida's living in Rome. Cola Vida's living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I recommend you try it as well. So when you think of the great wine regions of the world historically, I mean, you're going to be led back to Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, okay, maybe Piedmont, Italy, too. And as a chef growing up, boy, if you were working in great restaurants in the 70s and 80s, they were mostly all French, and we grew up drinking Bordeaux and Burgundy and Champagne with impunity. Well, fast forward to today, and I just got back from the 2015 Bordeaux harvest. We were there for a week with a bunch of sommeliers. It was so much fun, and I'll tell you, this isn't your grandfather's Bordeaux. There's a whole new generation of young vignerons working with this great terroir that they've lived on, this soil that they know that they've grown up with, and the great varietals that we all know and love, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot, Malbec. You know, this style of Bordeaux now that's younger, that's fresher, that's meant to be consumed now and not cellared, because honestly, which of us has a cellar? And who wants to buy a bottle of wine and wait 10 years? So the Bordeaux whites are amazing. You know, Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon, like, hello, two grapes that we know. The reds are all sorts of different stories, from the left bank style that are a little more Cabernet Sauvignon driven, a little more structured, right bank a little more Merlot, a little easier, a little more upfront friendly. But if you haven't thought about drinking Bordeaux wine, give it another shot. For $15 to $35 in that price range, which is my price range, there's tremendous value in there. So if you're walking past a Bordeaux aisle, stop, grab a great bottle. These are some of the most food-friendly wines on planet Earth. Yeah, they might have gotten some new. Hey, welcome back. Mike Hellemeco here, Food Talks the Show. Alice Firing is in the house. If you've listened to the show before, this is, I don't know, her 75th appearance. I bring her all the time. She's so much fun to talk to. We're kind of, Kindred Spirits, although you were so far ahead of me in terms of getting into the world of natural wine, congratulations. You had a great panel at Raw event with Pascaline.
Yeah, it was.
You two guys are just dynamic together. We'll throw a hint out because it's too early, but you've got a book coming out together.
In June, I just found out that it is.
I can't wait. And the name of the book is Dirty Wine, Dirty Wine, the story of Dirty Wine. What?
Dirty Guide to Wine.
but it's a pun. It's a tongue in cheek.
Yes, it is.
Because it's about, and I'll let you describe what it's about.
It is a wine book for beginners that is based on soil type. So basically, the organizing principle for how to learn about wine is through volcanic, sedimentary, and metamorphic soils. The beginning will be like many wine books. We'll have the basic rudimentary approach to wine, how to taste wine, how wine is made, and all the stuff that you need to know. So in that way, you really set up for what comes next and now, how to taste wine.
Now, I'm going to stop you. How wine is made, because this is something that if you listen to this show, maybe you're really into wine or maybe you just like listening to us talk about wine. Mm. But I always sort of took certain things for granted until relatively recently. And the how wine is made in quotation marks, not the wines that you drink and not the wines that I usually drink, but the dirty little secret in the wine industry is that because you don't have to declare anything on the bottle except sulfites and the alcohol level, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of ingredients as additives that can do anything you want post-crush. You can use any kind of equipment that you want. You can use reverse osmosis. You can strip it apart, put it back together again. I mean, it's like so much of the wine out there is just like a commercial commodity product.
Right. I know this is probably the great 1% that's natural. Actually, it's growing. It probably is about, I don't know, I'm just guessing, probably about the great 4%.
Nowadays, so 4% of the global production.
But that's just out of the top of my head. It's just I see so many even conventional wines adding a natural wine line now. So the numbers are going up there, even if they may not really pass muster for what I think is natural.
Which is still a question. I mean, this came up the other day when we were having a panel. So I had
you had Tony.
I had Tony Couture, who was such a cool guy.
He's the best.
I know his wines, and I posted something on Instagram or Facebook a little bit ahead of the fair, and I got a couple of comments. Eric Robert Longnot, if you know him, Long Island guy, is Couture's God. And so it was so funny because Tony Couture is this, like when you read his bio and you think about it. So born and raised in San Francisco, Bay Area, was a teenager in the 60s. His parents had a country home in Sonoma. Where they would take the kids out every weekend and for the summer. And the dad was an Italian guy, and like a lot of Italians, he just made wine, whatever the mix was. They made wine every year. And then Tony, I think, has a master's degree or degree in special ed, which is kind of bored with it, decided to become a winemaker. So it's like he's been doing this thing. I mean, you had the question, which thank you for, I credited
welcome.
You. You know, so this we're talking about like the 70s, mid-70s, late-70s, right around the time that Marcel Lapierre comes in from Beaujolais to Paris with his non-sulfured bio wines and says, what do you think? And it started a movement there.
Right.
Started in Beaujolais, you know, Kermit Lynch documents, those Four Horsemen, which is now five, which is more like dozens. You see it in the Loire Valley. I've traveled extensively through Sud de France, Languedoc-Roussillon, which because of the great weather down there is like the biggest, one of the biggest areas for the production of organic and bio wines. But
it's because land is cheap.
Because land is cheap, and you just have wonderful. You've got those diurnal temperature swings. You've got the wind off the ocean. It's just a perfect place to grow. So while this kind of took over all over France and has spread around Europe now, in the States, it's still such an outlier. So I was talking to Tony. I said, who else is doing this near you? And he just, I don't think anybody is, man. And
not there. No, where he is. No, but there are some people who have come out of the Tony School. And Hardestry
is Bloomer
one.
Creek up here? Are they? I mean, they were at the fair.
They were at the fair.
Are they Finger Lakes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've always loved their wines.
Yeah, they have gone through an evolution. When they first started, they weren't like that.
Right.
But they definitely were neighbors with Richard Fiegel, who was making pretty natural wines up there for Silver Thread. Unfortunately, he sold a few years ago to people who didn't even keep up his organic vineyard. So there goes that one. But
well, they do buy a country home, and
they wanted to make. It was actually an oenology professor, or and it was like wow. So. Of course, that they're the worst.
Because
well, because they are scientists first.
Takers.
They are scientists first, and so they want to make a sane wine with it's not a wine of emotion that they're making. They're and a lot of scientists like to dispel the myth of organics. You use your carbon footprint, they believe, is higher, which is widely debatable, but you can skew those statistics any way you want to.
Hmm. So,
but Bloomer is great.
Bloomer's great. So your backstory, I was at 10 Bells last Thursday. There was a little party that Isabel hosted in that back room for some of the people that were going to be participating, and I was there not for long, half an hour, so I had to go out to dinner. But I met a French woman who has a line that she brings in, who told me this great story that went back to the days where I think she was, like, maybe introduced you to Pascaline years ago in Paris. Do you know what I'm talking about? She's an importer. I wish I brought her name with me.
Yeah, no, she didn't. Well, she certainly didn't introduce me.
When did you meet Pascaline? So that's my question.
Okay, I met Pascaline in 2007. 2007, I was in Paris, and she had just started working for Rouge Tomat. Nobody knew really who Pascaline was except people in the Loire Valley. And Pierre Jeancou, who had the restaurant Racine, the wine bar Racine at the time, he said, when you come here, I want to do a tasting for you or with you. And I thought, there was a tasting, and there were going to be other people there, but it was just me and some people he wanted to introduce me to as far as bottles. And a couple of winemakers were there. One in particular that he was convinced that he's on a mission to get me to really love his wines, and I won't mention the name of the winemaker, but he is from the Auvergne because I don't want him to yell at me again the way he did at the Dives Bouteilles in 2009. Actually, was this 2007 or 2008? It may have been just after. No, it was 2007, somewhere around there. And so, lo and behold, he had Pascaline come to play sommelier. And then the next week, we rendezvoused in Vinexpo. And then Rouge Tomat was just starting work on their place, and she was here to help it. Oh, it was definitely 2007 that I met her. So she used my living room as her hotel. And so that was it. You know, she became my daughter instantly.
Yeah, and her mom was a redhead, too. You can't see Alice, but Alice is a redhead. Yeah, that was so funny you mentioned that.
But who was it who you met?
I'll email you back. I didn't bring the notes with me.
Was it?
She was French. She actually had a bio wine from Bordeaux, which was really unusual, a right bank wine that she brought. Called like X or something. I don't remember. I'm terrible with names.
What's her name? Fanny?
I don't know. I don't know. I have it written down somewhere. Don't worry.
Laura?
Don't worry about it. Okay. So back to what you do. I know I've asked this before, so I'll ask you again because I don't remember the answer. When did you get into natural wines? Because you have been on this bandwagon since. When you were considered
an
outlier. You were like the heretic. You were like, who is this crazy person? Because there just wasn't anybody talking about it.
No one was talking about.
And it was hard to find them. They weren't. There were not sections of stores carved out like you go into now, and there is a section for organic and bio. Right. And now we have importers that like they're bailiwick. I mean, Zev and blah blah blah. And on we can go. I mean, Dresdner, in his own way, was kind of an early guy there, but now you have that's their entire portfolio, so it's gotten easier. But what was it that drew you into it? You were always a wine drinker, and then you tasted a wine one day and just had that aha moment and said, why is this different?
Well, actually, kind of, yes. I was doing a book for Food & Wine magazine. It was the 2001 official wine guide. So I was doing all of this work in 2000, 2001.
That book they have that's like in the pocket guide
book? Yeah, exactly.
So a bunch of people have done that over the years.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So I got 1 year, and I think after that, it was like, we don't want her anymore.
I was about to say, I hate to say that. Dana Cowan was like, what's this shit?
it was just, I mean, I can't imagine. And I Remember the editor said, you certainly have a strong voice. I guess we'll work with it.
I guess we're stuck with it.
Yeah, it was for this year. But it was writing that book that I realized whole areas of the universe had been wiped out as far as wine and everything. That it was the height of internationalization. I hated so much of the wines I was tasting, and I didn't know what I'd be able to write about.
Right. So this is the time when you're getting these red wines that are just over-extracted, pumped down, over-ripe, over-oaked, over-built. I think for me, one of the kickers was drinking these, you know, sitting down with a bottle myself and having a bottle change over the course of 2 hours, 25 times. Mm-hmm. The first glass, the first sip was different than the middle of the glass, mm-hmm. than the end of the glass. Then the next pour was a different, right. not a different wine, but a different expression of the same wine. Yeah. And I know it's ridiculous, and I know it sounds like I drank the Kool-Aid, but you can almost feel in your palate, on your tongue, life in these wines.
But haven't drunk the Kool-Aid. Well, you have, which is why you appreciate this, because you know what the Kool-Aid is like. So you have, but this isn't the Kool-Aid, because it is what sulfur and high levels of sulfur and all that, not to say all those other controlling agents, it really does put a lid on a wine and it forces it to stay in one place.
Right.
So it absolutely is the nature of a low sulfur wine to be free.
And you feel it in the palate. It's crazy. And I was talking to Isabelle Giron. I think that I bumped into her a couple of weeks ago at Rouge, because it was another pre-raw party night. It was in the front, and my son and I were on the way to Brooklyn to go eat. But I wanted to go there and say hi and see Pascalina.
I want to see your son.
I had to see. Well, you saw him. You had dinner with him.
He's hysterical.
He's so funny. So, and Isabelle had this great description of, like, because I was telling her about sort of my evolution of drinking, you know, as an old guy that's been drinking wine since the, you know, the Eisenhower years or something, that, you know, now when I go back and I drink this much more traditional, like the way wine had been made post-World War II, probably the zenith of the worst years was the late 60s, early 70s, mm-hmm. when it was, you know, industrial farming, catalogs of yeasts, you know, tons of spray, tons of nitrogen, just mm-hmm. the worst. But there were still some great wines coming out of Bordeaux. There were still some great wines coming out of the world. But she had this great, she described to me, she said, you know, so much of those wines, all of them really, they're mummified was the word that she used, because mm-hmm. they need to produce it. You know, once it's done with the oaking and once it's in the bottle and once it's rested in the bottle for the year or so before the release, they want it, it'll age a bit, but they want that thing to stay the same.
Right.
So, and the mummification was perfect. I began to think of like a preserved dead body, which is kind of what it is.
Yeah, that is a good one. I haven't heard her use that. But so basically that experience led me to why do I like these wines as opposed to those wines? And the wines that I was looking for were... well, we didn't use the word natural then, but I just started doing a lot of investigation into wine technology and realized what I was liking was organically farmed, native yeast fermentation. I thought the problem was new oak, because back then it was everything was tasted like cherry vanilla if it was a red wine, and everything tasted like Chardonnay fully oaked if it was a white, no matter what. So it was really, I was in a search to try to find traditional wines, and that led me to natural wine. So I've been writing about it since 2001.
And Georgian wines before anybody was out there, too. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
That was really brilliant. So let's talk about, I want to get into the book in a minute, but the thing about yeast is so important. You know, we grow grapes, so, I mean, farming practices are huge, and that's a big part of wine. But to me, like, if I wanted to pick, like, the moment, like, a window where the expression of that grape is going to follow through into the bottle of wine, it's fermentation. It's native yeasts. It's how they're fermenting, how they're controlling fermentation. But it's to think that 97% of the wines, when they come into reception, once they're selected and go through, they're just gassed with SO2 to kill the natural yeast, to mm-hmm. kill the bacteria, inoculate it, so they can then go into a catalog and say, oh, I'm going to use yeast number B172 mm-hmm. because I'm looking for my Sauvignon Blanc to be really grassy, cat pissy, yucca. I mean, there are those books. There's books that have thousands of yeasts that describe, I mean, that's, yeah. What are you doing? You're like, you've killed the grape, and you're just making something artificial.
Yeah, it's really the flavor and fragrance suitcase that they have in the perfume industry. That's what the yeast catalog does for the wine.
Because so much of when we're sniffing, we talked about, I mean, in your panel, we talk about, like, so much of us appreciating wine is putting it to your nose, letting those phenolic compounds release, and then picking up all of those esters and volatile compounds that are coming out. That's, I mean, we can detect tens of thousands of them. We really don't taste much in our mouths with our nose closed, but so much of that, what happens in fermentation is what's expressing itself then at that point. It's so much of those compounds are a result of fermentation. So like natural yeast is critical to the wine. If you're talking about terroir, it has to be natural yeast.
Of course it's critical.
It's absolutely critical.
But, you know, terroir has become a marketing term, and most of wine is produced because a marketer decides what the people want.
Right.
So, and that is a commercial product.
Well, you had a book on that. You had a book about the Robert Parker's in the title, I think, the Parkerization of...
For the love, wait, that's my last book.
There's love in every title.
There's the Battle for Wine and Love, or How I Saved the World from Parkerization.
Yeah, because the hegemonic effect of those scores in the 90s was just insane. Winemakers were making wine so Parker would give them the 94s and 95s so they could sell them for whatever they got.
But right now we're going to be seeing that with natural wine. I mean, I'm not flattering myself, but people will, and I've seen people try to please me with the wine. I know they probably do that with Pascaline as well. And it makes me feel very unhappy.
So talk about the book. The book is so fantastic. And I can't believe nobody wrote this book before. Because as a wine lover, I don't have any MSM anything. I've never taken a wine class in my life. I just love wine. Then I taste, and I was a chef, so I have a good tasting equipment, if you will. But soil typicity and rock base, it's so critical. And so they say, technically speaking, like the scientist half of the science,
right,
that you cannot taste minerality in wine, period.
Right. It's a little
bit
like,
we know this not to be true as tasters.
Well, the whole minerality thing, I think that minerality debate is the same debate, same kind of straw man that people in the natural wine world or against the natural wine world say there is no such thing as a natural wine. You basically, a natural wine is vinegar. So you can't taste minerality, but that is the fire to distract from the fact that soil really does make a difference where you grow it. And I'm not saying, and the book is not making the case, that you can taste flint, that you can taste granite or you can smell it. But there's something structurally that relates back to where a wine comes from. And even if this is not true, I still say it doesn't matter, because what I'm hoping to do here is to bring people back to thinking, you know, wines taste differently when it comes from Piemonte than the Finger Lakes. Now, why is that? It's climate and it's soil, and the climate is going to change and light is changed, but the soil is one of the last things to change. You do change it through farming, but the actual bedrock stays the same. Right. And so at least that grounds us back into place, because the people who really believe in terroir believe the grape just is the interpreter of place. And that is what got us in. Not that, oh my God, I love Malbec, I love Chardonnay. That isn't what gets us into wine. It is the mystery of travel and history through what we are drinking, and the experience of drinking it together and the conversation. And it is an ultimately cultural, human experience.
Great. Perfect. I agree. Well, so you and Pascaline did that panel, and it was really neat. And Pascaline was talking about, like, for example, Muscadet. She's from Loire. So we know if we're talking Pascaline, we're going to be talking Chenin. We're going to be talking Cab Franc. We're going to be talking Muscadet. They talk about, you know, the various, I mean, the lay of the land, because there is no one style at all. But, you know, her ability to taste Muscadet grown over certain soil types as just markers right away that if she's in a blind tasting, which she's done a million times, she's a master sommelier. So clearly she's got the tasting and the chops to break wines down blind. But, you know, those are markers for her. Mm-hmm. And I think for all of us, that idea of, you know, she was a huge fan of limestone, right?
No, she's actually a big fan of schist.
Of schist, I'm sorry.
I'm the granite girl.
Okay. Well, you had some quote where somebody said, limestone is for rich people and granite.
Yeah, that was Jose Pastor. It's in the book.
But that is the line.
I love it.
Right? Because when you think of limestone, you're thinking champagne. You're thinking
of this. And so we both really like low level, in quotes, terroir. But yeah, Jose, because we both love granite so much. Yeah. It's like limestone is for rich people, granite is for the people.
I love that line.
And poor regions usually have granite. So it's like, wonderful wines.
So what have you been drinking lately? Tell me about the fair. What was the takeaway? Was there something? I mean, it was usually successful.
It was
I know
successful.
When I saw Isabel on the Thursday before the Sunday, she said, don't even bother coming Sunday because it's 1,000 people. It's sold out. It's going to be crazy. And my son went. I gave him the ticket. I said, go early. I get a phone call from him at 1:30, and he's like, where is this place? I'm like, what the fuck, dude? It opened at like 11. Like, I told you to go early. I guess even you're 26, early.
Yeah, early is like...
takes on different... Word. And then he texted me like just like something when he was there, just like one word of like, geez, like, yeah, dude.
He's, right.
He had trouble talking to the winemakers. Like, you could barely get in line to taste.
It was way beyond packed. It was very difficult to move. And when you're dealing with tasting, or if you really want to do tasting, it was very hard. You had to be very competitive to get to a table. However, I've only been to one wine experience in my life, and I don't need to go to a spectator one ever again. The crowd was so much more humane and decent.
Oh, it's true. I went to Spectator once. It's funny.
So
I went to Spectator once. I have it at the Marriott, and I was like, never again.
Never again.
I did it because I was doing radio, and someone invited me, and I was home. And then Drew called me this week. This year, Drew called me. He said, what are you doing tonight? You want to come to my... I said, no. Drew, I love you, but I've been to one of those things before. It's like a cattle car of guys in suits.
People were very, very polite. There was no shoving to get. But, of course, there were no superstar wines, so people weren't there for status symbol. People were there just to taste and discover. So I had to do a seminar on Sunday and on Monday. And it's really hard for me to taste before I do a seminar. So I kind of, and then it was just too jammed, and I said, forget about it. But I did taste some things in the morning before people got there. That was good. I talked to a lot of the winemakers afterwards. They were really happy with the quality of person that showed up.
That's great. And to that end, I mean, there was a lot of, I mean, I'm 60, so everybody under 40 I refer to as a kid anymore. But it looked like there were a lot of like 20-something and 30-somethings there. Am I wrong about that? I really can't tell
their
ages.
It was all over the map as far as ages. And there were a lot of young kids there.
A lot of young kids, which is great. And then, I mean, you must love this as someone who's been in this tank for a while, of just seeing how... younger, have this whole generation of millennials or X's or Y's, you ever want to call them, how stoked they are about the world of wine and knowledgeable.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It was young, and it was also, in my reading that I did for the Georgian book, For the Love of Wine, I can't remember any of the name of my books. For the Love of Wine, my Odyssey Through the World's Most Ancient Wine Culture. Get it, Alice.
There you go. And it's, so, and there's a big fair view. You call those things on the screen.
There wasn't one person who asked me to sign the book there who is from New York.
Wow.
A lot of people from Canada, Japan, Mexico, California, Chicago, Ohio, that state. Let's not talk about Ohio.
Let's not talk about anything
But I was really pretty impressed.
That's so cool.
It was people really traveling for it.
And they came to Bushwick.
They're willing to come to Bushwick. New Yorkers don't want to come to Bushwick. Every New Yorker I talked like, were like bitching and moaning. Sorry, we're talking in Bushwick. But it was deeper in Bushwick.
So when's the book come out?
The book comes out in June.
So I'm getting you on. This is a done deal. So you and Pascaline, by then, hopefully the New York Times, she's done. She's cool. She's rude. She can take a little time off. We're going to get you out here because I want to bore down on that discussion with the two of you because you two are so great. Great panel. Was... Thank you. Alice Feiring, by the way, spell your last name.
Feiring.
First name, Alice. Go to Firing Line. Subscribe to her newsletter.
Subscribe to the newsletter.
It's great. It is really great. There's like, I don't know, 6 or 7 a year. She's great. No one's paying her to discuss their wine. She's a completely free spirit. Able to do whatever she says. And she's a great writer. I mean, did you major in like writing or something?
It was a minor.
Well, you're great.
Thank you.
So anyway, Alice Firing has been my guest. Firing Line, you can find out about her there. Thanks for listening. Next week, I am off. I cannot be in the city next week, unfortunately. But the following week, we're back live again with some great guests. Folks, take care. And we can make America great again. Yeah, Peru. Uh-huh. Okay, I thought we were great. But anyway, Alice, thanks for coming out. Folks, we'll see you in 2 weeks. Take care. Whoa!
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.